ultimately, at the end of the day, I really wanted people to beat it, throw it on the ground, and then talk to their friend about it and be like, we have to talk about this book. Because, like, that's the kind of book I love.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Zakiya Delilah Harris, author of the psychological thriller, The Other Black Girl. The genre-bending book infuses horror into the lives of two Black women working in publishing, an imagined scenario ripped from the pages of Zakiya's own life.
The real horror that I was first thinking about while writing this was of that horror of what if this Black person who's starting to work with me, who I think is going to be an ally, turns me down, does not want to be friends with me, does not have my best interest. Like, I find that personally horrifying.
Zakiya worked at Penguin Random House for 3 years before embarking on the journey of writing her first novel. What she realized after receiving a promotion that made her leave the industry. Why she says the main setting of her novel is a placeholder for any white or male-dominated industry. And how the liberation she found in her big chop tangled themselves in her fiction. That and more when Black and Published continues. All right, so Zakiya, my first question is, when did you know that you were a writer?
I knew pretty early on, I have to say. My dad's a writer, so he was working, he used to have a column in the New Haven Register. I grew up in Connecticut, like my protagonist. But yeah, he was a writer, always has been. So being around that at a young age, I definitely picked up on that. But I also just love to read. I was pretty shy. I like to be in my head. Even then, I remember making up, like, you know, imaginary friends and all these narratives and things like that. So really when I was a kid. But I don't think I really knew it would be something I could do, like, for real, until many years later, I think. Really until a few years ago.
So then what was that point that you realized this was something that you could do for life? Because you spent years in publishing, which is not separate from writing, but it's a different side of the writing process.
I was in publishing for 2 or 3 years, not a very long time, but enough time for me to kind of get a sense that, like, all right, I really loved being on the editing side. I enjoyed working in that kind of way of, like, playing with words and figuring out, you know, the best way to tweak the sentence and all of those parts. But I also, at the time when I was working in book publishing, was also writing reviews on the side. I was ghostwriting. I was just trying to stay in that world because before publishing, I did my MFA in nonfiction writing. And so I knew I would lose it if I didn't keep doing it. And so these two kind of sides were competing for a while for my time, and I was making it work until I decided to, I had the idea for this book right around the time that I had been promoted to being an assistant editor, which was supposed to be like, yes, I made it. I made it to the next level. Now I'm not just an EA, I'm an AE. and I was supposed to be ecstatic, but I remember being so sad about that because I was like, man, this means I now have to, like, put in the hustle. You know, I have to do all the stuff that young people who want to work in book publishing, especially young people of color, like, you have to hustle hard. And I knew I didn't want to give up my dream yet for that. You know, I didn't want to be like, I wanted to help authors, but I wanted to help myself first, you know?
We appreciate your honesty about that. So I have two questions. I want to know, what is the hustle that you mentioned that, you know, Black people in publishing have to go through to get to the next level?
For me, the way I saw it, it meant being completely on it all the time, always having your feelers open, working on weekends, reading on weekends, in some cases, hopefully pulling in writers who you've seen on Twitter or writers you've seen on Instagram. Like, I mean, that's the way I would have possibly done it, of finding voices that hadn't been published yet. And that requires a lot of work and a lot of being in touch with the pulse, because there aren't many young people in those top editorial positions, at least what I was seeing. And there were very, very, very few women of color in those top positions. And I just feel like Black women working twice as hard, like we've heard this mantra so many times, but I also think to prove yourself in that space, you have to hustle even harder because it's hard out there. And scarcity, there are so few spots. And yeah, you got to really want it. And I just didn't really want it.
Okay. And so obviously you wanted the writing. So then from getting the MFA in creative nonfiction to writing a novel, what was that switch like? Because I imagine creative nonfiction is much harder.
It's different. It's funny because I applied for both fiction and nonfiction for my program, and I got waitlisted for fiction and for nonfiction, which surprised me because I was like, I don't really do this ever. Like, I had taken a couple classes in undergrad that I, you know, were really fun and I enjoyed, like that required me to interview people and talk to people in a way I'd never had before. And I was really intrigued by that. And for a little while, I thought, okay, like, maybe this is my path. And so I did the nonfiction program and ended up loving it, loving the people that I met in the program and airing out things about just like my childhood and things I'd experienced as a young Black woman growing up in a mostly white space in Connecticut, because I did come from this privileged and middle-class background, but I still feel and have felt in these ways constrained, whether it's like about my hair or about how I talk. And so I started writing these essays during my MFA, never did anything with them though, because when I finished my MFA, I was like, I was 21, 22, I believe. I was young enough where I was like, I know I need to like let these things simmer and sit and have a little bit more time to process and think about publishing them later. And then when I had this idea for the novel, though, I'd just thrown out another novel that I had written so many pages of, but just couldn't get to work. This idea for The Other Black Girl came into my head. And as I was writing, I was just, Nella popped into my head as the character. And then of course, all of my experiences of like, well, the whole idea at the very beginning of me writing this book was two Black women having a hard time in this very white workplace. I was like, well, why? And I knew all the reasons why that might happen, because of everyone watching them, because of the pressures that Nella feels to perform a certain way with Hazel versus with her white coworkers. And so it just really came natural to kind of pull from a lot of these pieces I've been writing before and also poke fun at them and all of the different, you know, all the different conversations about being Black and why it's ridiculous that like we oftentimes are like, oh, you know, that's not truly Black or like those kind of things. But it's also like, where does that actually come from? Like, why do we think that way? All of those are conversations I've been having.
I want to get something clear, because you have in the opening of the book an epigraph of a quote from Tana Rivdu. So is The Other Black Girl supposed to be horror?
It's a blend of things, I say. yes, I think it's horror, but in the way that, like, we're living in horror right now, I think. I mean, always have. Especially as Black people, just thinking about these last couple weeks and last 2 years and last decades. But the real horror that I was first thinking about while writing this was of that horror of what if this Black person who's starting to work with me, who I think is going to be an ally, turns me down, does not want to be friends with me, does not have my best interest. Like, I find that personally horrifying. So I was really playing with that idea. But then, of course, as I kept going, it's like, okay, again, of course, institutions like publishing that have been historically very white have historically kept people you know, who cannot afford to work there, which oftentimes happens to be people of color, out, the gatekeeping, all of that is horrifying when you've, like Nella, spent all of this time playing by the rules and you're not getting what you deserve. And I feel like that's been what we've been getting for the last 400 years. Like, we have tried so many times, so many different ways to go with the system, and the system's clearly rotten at the root, you know? And so I was like, really getting into just this idea, all the different ways Black people have been living this horrifying life here in this country, but also the ways we've been depicted in horror movies. And I feel like now there's really a fun reckoning happening in literature, in movies and TV, where like we are getting to reclaim the narrative of horror and actually be like, no, you know what? This is actually really horrifying. Like, we don't have to make up things. Like, this is actually true. Although there are made up things in this book, obviously.
Yes. There are made up things in the book, but then there are also parts that read very almost autobiographical and then very true to life. There's a line that you have on page 32 where you're like imitating this publishing meeting, marketing room, something like that. And it's like, didn't we publish this book by that Black writer just last year? Which made me wonder then, you're writing this book, you've worked in publishing, and as much as this is fiction, the novel is really an assassination of the publishing industry. So I'm surprised that I was even able to read the book, that it even came out. So why put this out there? And then what was the journey like for you to get this novel published where you're criticizing the very industry that's helping you tell the story?
Yeah, I'm still, every now and then I'm still like, wait, what? How has this happened? Yeah, I mean, it's funny because when I started writing this very, very beginning, I had the idea of Mill and Hazel, but I definitely told myself like, but it's not going to be publishing though. Like, publishing will be a placeholder. I'll change the industry. Like, I could change it to something else. But this idea really came from publishing. Like, the fact that it sprung out of my own feeling of what it would be like to maybe have another full-time Black female coworker, just any Black full-time coworker who is close to my age working near me, also having the same concerns and trying to figure this stuff out. That all really came from this book, and it felt like changing it to another industry would have been a disservice to the story and also to the fact, which is that publishing has a problem, and it knows it has a problem. Still has a problem. So when I decided to just lean into it, I definitely was very nervous in a lot of ways for various reasons about possibly getting an agent for this book, because I, again, was just writing in this vacuum of not knowing. But it was fun. And once I found an agent who truly understood, she had been an assistant. My agent, Stephanie Delman, had been an assistant for years in publishing and had worked her way up. But like, she's also young and she got it. She understood where this book was coming from. And so it was definitely an interesting experience kind of visiting publishing houses, because we got a lot of great reception, surprisingly. And it was very strange because, you know, we'd be talking to people, editors, white editors for the most part. And they'd be like, you know, this book is so real. Like, I feel like I know this person. I know this person. And it was funny. It's just like, well, if we all know these people, then why is this still happening? You know? And I still find that really fascinating, because I do hope that it's moving in the right direction and that we've gotten way further along than where we were when I was writing this book. But it's hard. It's hard to hope for that.
It makes me wonder when you talk about, you're talking to editors who say, oh, it seems so real. I know this person. I feel like I know these people. Did anyone ever ask, like, I don't know the publishers that you shopped it to, but did anyone ever say, you know, are you talking about us? Like, was there ever that kind of like almost like protective reaction that they didn't want to air their dirty laundry?
No, you know, I never got that. And I think part of it is because I really did hope to make this funny and exaggerated in ways that I think that a lot people who work in publishing and know the publishing world, like, kind of know is ridiculous, but also they know where it comes from, right? Like, I wanted to have that gem of, oh, this actually rings so true. Like, is this satire or not? Because I think by putting, you know, by putting my own past job on blast in that way didn't feel productive. It's about what the vibe of this industry does to a young person, does to a young Black person who feels like they can't speak up, who feels like they have to kind of move in this confined box.
That, and but it also goes to what you said earlier, that publishing really was a placeholder. Like, yes, it comes out of your experience, exactly. And that was, but that could be any industry that's white and male dominated, which is every industry. It could have been Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. It could have been my former industry, which was television news. It could be anything. So mm-hmm. as much as it was specific, it was also universal. So I really enjoyed that about it. So since we're here and we've talked about the journey and the book, and I just have questions about the book because I read it. Mm-hmm. Let's do the reading and then we'll get to all of my questions of how you bent my mind and I don't appreciate it.
Sounds great.
Black and Published family, it's time for the reading. The Other Black Girl follows Nella Rogers, the only Black editorial assistant at Wagner Books, until Hazel Mae McCall shows up. Nella thinks she's found a friend, but as the story unfolds, she learns that she's just a pawn in a plot that goes back decades. One that forces her to decide if she wants to save herself or succumb to the forces and pressures around her. Here's Zakiya.
I'll read from chapter one, which is the very first part of this book I ever wrote, and really didn't change much. Chapter one, July 23rd, 2018, Wagner Books, Midtown, Manhattan. The first sign was the smell of cocoa butter. When it initially crept around the wall of her cubicle, Nella was too busy filing a stack of pages at her desk, aligning each and every one so that the manuscript was perfectly flush. She was so intent on completing this task, Vera Perini needed everything to be flush, always, that she had the nerve to ignore the smell. Only when it inched up her nostrils and latched onto a deep part of her brain did she stop what she was doing and lift her head at an interest. It wasn't the scent alone that gave her pause. Nella Rogers was used to all kinds of uninvited smells, usually terrible ones. Since she was merely an editorial assistant at Wagner Books, she had no private office and therefore no walls or windows. She and the other open space assistants were at the mercy of a hard-boiled egg or the passing of gas. They were often left to suffer the consequences for what felt like an hour afterward. Adjusting to such close proximity had been so difficult for Nella during her first few weeks at Wagner that she practiced breathing through her mouth, even when it wasn't called for, like when she was deciding between granolas at the grocery store or when she was having sex with her boyfriend, Dylan. After about 3 months of failed self-training, she had broken down and purchased the lavender reed diffuser that had the words, "Just Breathe," scrawled across its front in gold cursive letters. Its home was the far corner of her desk, where it sat just beneath the first edition of Kindred that Owen had given her shortly after they started dating. Nella eyed the gold foil letters and frowned. Could it have been the lavender diffuser she smelled? She inhaled again, craning her neck upward so that all she could see were the gray and white tiles that lined the ceiling. No, she'd been correct. That was cocoa butter, all right. And it wasn't just any cocoa butter. It was brown butter, her favorite brand of hair grease. Nella looked around. Once she was sure the coast was clear, she stuck her hand into her thick black hair and pulled a piece of it as close to her nose as she could. She'd been proudly growing an afro over the last 3 years, but the strand still landed unsatisfyingly between her nose and her cheek. Nonetheless, it felt close enough to tell her that the brown butter smell wasn't coming from her own hair. What she was smelling was fresh, a coat applied within the last hour or so, she guessed. This meant one of two things. One of her white colleagues had started using brown butter, or more likely, since she was pretty sure none of them had accidentally stumbled into the natural hair care aisle, there was another Black girl on the 13th floor.
So I'm glad that you started with the first chapter, because I don't think I've ever entered a book through smell. And cocoa butter is so specific, especially in the Black community. Like, you know when you smell cocoa butter, like, somebody lotion today. So then, why did you want to ground readers in this specific cultural aesthetic to start your book?
I love that question. This is the very first scene that I wrote of this book. And I wrote it while I was sitting at my cubicle still. I was still working in publishing. So it really came out of me imagining what it would be like to literally have this other presence come in. And I'm like, wait a minute, because it's such a very specific feeling, right? Of working in an office that we don't necessarily have as much anymore, I guess. But I remember what that feeling was like when you would just know who is around by who's walking around, what footsteps you hear, what cough you hear, right? And so that there's an intimacy, but also there's the separation. And I felt like it would be really fun to see someone literally sniffing out companionship at the office. And that tension, I thought would be a nice way to set up that dynamic that happens later with the two of them.
Yeah, you got us all. So with that being the entry point, and then hair plays a big role throughout the novel. I mean, even though that was chapter one, it has a prologue and an opening where, you know, there's this person that we don't know. We come to find out is another essential character in the book who's can't stop scratching her scalp and all of those things. Why was hair the point where you wanted to weave the story and create like that horrifying reality, but then also to, I guess, distinguish each character's personality as well?
For me personally, my hair has really affected a lot of my feelings about myself, my feelings about my Blackness. When I was younger, I mentioned I grew up in this very white space. And so for a lot of my young life, I really wanted to have straight hair, like all my white friends, like kind of all like my Black Barbie dolls at the time, like everyone had that straight hair, you know, and I wanted that. And I did that. I relaxed my hair for over a decade. And it got to a point where once I'd moved to Brooklyn, a lot of different things were going on. A lot of protests were going on. I was doing my MFA. It was getting in touch with this voice that I hadn't used while writing my personal essays and things like that. And I saw this documentary about the Black Panthers, and I saw Kathleen Cleaver talking about why they wear their hair natural. And I was just thinking about, why have I not been wearing my hair natural for all this time? Like, I don't even know what's under there, you know? And so at some point after that, I ended up just doing the big chop, cutting it all off in a barber shop. And it felt so good. And I felt so connected to myself and my Blackness in a way I've never felt before. So anyway, I was imagining that for Nella and how that affects her feeling about herself, the life that she shed before she was living in New York, before she met Malaika, before she really came into her own. And now she's excited that she has discovered that about herself and thinks, cool, this will be a bonding way, like a bonding moment for me and Hazel. And it does in a lot of ways, but then it doesn't. And so I really wanted to have that in there. I think the natural hair movement has been amazing. But I also think like there are still stigmas. There are still these kind of judgments we make about one another, even if we're not realizing it, about like, oh, you're natural, like Nella Sue Tazel, you're natural too in this white space. Like, you must have the same beliefs as me. And it's like, that's not the case. We obviously all have our own opinions. Our hair doesn't necessarily have anything to do with it. But there are these ties and these signals that we do give off to one another about who we are and where, like, and we make interpretations, and those interpretations might not be right. So it was really also questioning my own preconceptions about natural hair and like hair in general. And so it was fun to poke fun at that, if that makes sense.
So embedded in the book is like this mystery of what happened to like this dynamic duo author editor relationship, Kendra Ray Phillips and Diana Gordon. So In crafting them and talking about Burning Heart, which is the fictional novel that was like this runaway bestseller in the 80s that got the movie and the musical treatment, were you trying to pay homage, of course, to Alice Walker, but then also like the relationship between maybe Toni Morrison and Lucille Clifton or Toni Morrison and Angela Davis and her time at Random House when publishing did start to open up to Black writers because Toni Morrison was there as their editor?
Yeah, I absolutely had Toni Morrison in mind. I mean, I worked at Penguin Random House and I remember seeing her name, you know, everywhere on the walls. And I was like, I mean, I didn't know anything about publishing before going in. So I was like, wow, this is really cool. Like, this is great that she was a part of Penguin Random House. And it gave me an impression of what publishing was. But then, of course, as I continued to be in it, I was like, oh, well, that's not, that happens, but also we're not at this place where we have tons of Black female editors everywhere. And that really comes through, I hope, through Nella's journey of the way she kind of romanticizes the past, the way that I think a lot of us do this, right? Where I think about like, oh, the old times, we're like, everyone was like, there's so much magic happening, but we don't necessarily see all of the hard parts about it, right? Like all of the those microaggressions, everything that I imagine Toni Morrison must have experienced working in that space, the way that you just never know the whole story. And so it was another way to poke fun at Nella's idea of like, oh, you know, that was so great. And I can do this one day, but also like, girl, it's not going to be that easy. Like, and it's not. And all the ways we can just never truly understand the past and how the past is always here with us.
So I have to be honest, when your book first came out, I remember reading the description and I was like, I don't know if I want to read this because I don't know if I want my mind twisted in all of these different ways from the way the copy sounds on the flap. So like I would put it in the cart, remove from cart, put it in the cart, remove from cart, put it in the cart, remove from cart. And so finally I put it in the cart and I bought it. And then I got the book and you reached out. And so I was reading the book and I was like, see, this is what I didn't want to happen, right? So as I'm reading the book, I was like, I feel like I'm being gaslit as a reader. I feel like all the characters are being gaslit. Like, what is going on? How did you keep the secrets that you kept in the craft? Like, was all of that living in your head at once? Or did that come through revision? And then why? Like, I'm still, like, I'm not going to give it away. But Black women, when you read this book, you're going to get to a point where you figure it out and you're going to be so mad. At least I was.
First of all, thank you for your honesty. I love it. I really appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, I was being selfish when I wrote this book. Let me tell you, like I was writing what I love to consume. Like the best example I can give, which isn't quite the same, but like Severance twisted my mind. There are twists and turns. And I'm still wondering months after finishing that season one of like, what just happened? And I was like, oh, that was such a fun, weird exercise. And that's what I enjoy. So I really wanted, ultimately at the end of the day, I really wanted people to read it, throw it on the ground, and then talk to their friend about it and be like, we have to talk about this book. Because like, that's the kind of book I love. That's the kind of book, TV show, movie I love. Like something that causes conversation.
Yeah, when I DM'd you, I think I had 65 pages left. And I was like, I just cursed and screamed in my bedroom like, fuck. I was so mad. I was like, no. And so then I'm reading. And I'm like, no, girl, no, no, girl, no.
Yes, just no girl, no on every page. When you messaged me too, I was like, I wonder where she is. Should I warn? No, I'm not going to warn her. I'm not going to say anything. I'm just going to let her keep screaming.
It was fine. It's all good. Back to the interview, because I don't know how much of that conversation is going to actually make it to the end. Was your intent to show how envy and jealousy and not speaking up for yourself can lead to madness, because as much as this is like a thriller, or I don't know the right publishing language for what this is, but as mm-hmm. much as it does that type of mental bending, it also is very, I guess, indicative of what can happen to Black people in white spaces when yeah. they're experiencing microaggressions and racism, and what it feels like to speak up or even not to speak up.
Yes, definitely. And that whole kind of questioning of like, am I crazy? Did that white shop owner look at me that way because I'm Black, or are they just having a bad day? Like, those are thoughts that I am constantly thinking about. I mean, not all the time, but it definitely affects the way I move through the world, even now, and not in an office setting, but just like period. And so I really wanted to convey that through Nella's experience. And because we talk a lot about the tolls of being Black in white spaces, those conversations have been going on for a while. And this book is obviously not the first, but I really feel like it's easy to just be like, all right, like, we'll just put more Black people in this space then, or we'll just do this. And it's like, well, it's not that simple. It takes more than that, because a lot of places and businesses are not dealing with the actual lack of diversity, like intentional or just really thoughtful diversity. They're very quick to just be like, all right, we fixed this, we tweeted, we did this thing. And it's like, it's not that easy.
No. And so in offering solutions, some that aren't as nefarious as what you've concocted here. you have a line on page 266 where it says, now Kendra Ray, that woman knew about sins, someone who rejected what was expected of her as a Black woman in a predominantly white industry. If this is a sin, if, you know, not conforming is a sin, what is the safe haven?
I mean, being a yeser, just being like, yep, going along with, I mean, I don't really believe that's the right way to do it, but I really wanted to kind of set up this dichotomy of what happens when you are an independent thinker, when you are saying what you actually feel, and then what happens when you're not. And all of that responsibility, we take it in different ways. It depends on who we are, what we can afford to do financially also, all of those things.
You had mentioned Hazel and Nella, and you know how one feels, oh, they like her better than me now. And there's a line about, you know, the promises that were broken that she owed her just by being another Black girl. What mm-hmm. do you think are those promises that Black people owe to each other, or that just people of color owe to each other in, you know, a white working space?
Yeah. I mean, I was definitely raised by two parents who nodded at other Black people when they were walking down the street, or said hi to other Black people, strangers out in the world, especially in settings where there weren't many of us. And so that's something that I have always felt like doing. And so in that space, I feel like the least one can do is that when you're not necessarily working together. But in the case of Nella and Hazel, I believe that the right thing would be, of course, community, of helping each other, helping build one another up, of having each other's back, not embarrassing one another or throwing one under the bus, and just kindness and grace. But it's also hard to tell every Black woman, of course, or every Black person, or every person of color, you need to constantly be on the lookout for your sisters and brothers and your people, because it doesn't work that way. I know everyone doesn't operate that way. And I think, though, a lot of this could be solved if, like I was saying before, there were honest and true diversity in the actual institution itself. Really making sure that you are hiring from different spaces, but that there are also people at the top representing not just white men. I think that kind of visibility will make people feel especially Black people, feel like we can be individuals. Like, we don't have to constantly be in comparison with someone else. Like, we can just be ourselves. We're not supposed to represent the whole race. But unfortunately, I still feel like we feel this pressure that we are representing everybody.
So then with that said, everything comes to a head in one epic confrontation. And it reminded me of that scene in Black Panther when T'Challa and Killmonger are fighting and they're having that having that conversation. Was that what you were trying to evoke before the Black girls? Because I was like, we can all get excited about the T'Challa-Killmonger conversation, but this one felt especially for the Black
girls. Yeah. I actually, you know, that's the first time anyone has ever brought that up to me. I started writing this book after running into another Black woman in the bathroom, having that moment of like, who are you? I don't know you. And like, we never talked. And I kind of like was trying to like catch her eye and nothing happened. So the bathroom kind of had a symbolism for me, if you will. But I had read Passing by Nella Larsen the year before, or earlier that year when I started writing this. And so, and there are those moments between them where it's like, they know this thing about one another, but nobody else around them knows it. And I think that tension is so fun and also so scary and just rich. And so that's really where that ultimate scene happened, came from.
Yeah, because, you know, women own the bathroom, one. But, you know, for Black women especially, it's where it's like where we go to reset ourselves or take ourselves apart or put ourselves back together. So that confrontation there had a lot of symbolism. I really love that. And one last question on the book. Did you name her Nella after Nella Larsen?
I did. I loved that name. And it was just came out so smoothly when I was writing.
All right. So now I want to transition to a speed round, a little game before I let you go for the afternoon. So what is your favorite book?
My favorite book changes very often, but I would say my favorite book is Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Like that book, especially the hair conversations, blew me away. The fact that she was in New Haven, the character in the book was in New Haven, and I was like, I know this world. Americana, it's a beautiful book.
Who is your favorite author?
This might be a surprise, but my favorite author would be Stephen King. I really, really love how he is able to take very seemingly everyday kind of things and people and really play with that and put them in really scary situations.
So then with that said, what is your favorite scary movie?
Oh, that's a really hard one. I would say my favorite scary movie is the Night of the Living Dead. I saw that when I was pretty young. I was a teen, early teens, I think, with my dad. And the end of that movie is so heartbreaking. Everything goes, like zombies are coming, black guy survives, but at the end he does not make it because they think the white people who are going around rounding up all of the zombies think he's a zombie, and he ends up dying in the end because they shoot him. And also the fact that he was a black man playing that role was not necessarily intended. Like, they weren't trying to send a message. But it sends a very interesting message, I think, about being black in America. So I love that movie. It's also just scary.
So then you talked about movies and books. What do you think is the best book to movie or TV show adaptation?
Ooh, I thought Passing was really well done. I think it was super well done. Also the adaptation of Carrie by Stephen King, the original adaptation, not the new one. That one was great because he's basic.
If the other black girl got the movie treatment, who would you want to play Nella and Hazel?
Ooh, I get this question a lot because we're actually working on the TV adaptation of this book. So, but I never have an answer because I'm like, I don't know actors. But Kiki Palmer comes up all the time in my mind as Hazel. Or Nella, though. But like, it's hard. So yeah, I think of Kiki Palmer. I also think of Kiki Layne. I think she's great. I love her and everything she's in. So just, yeah, lots of beautiful, talented young Black actors out there, though.
You mentioned earlier that your MFA was creative nonfiction. So is there anything in nonfiction after doing the novel that you want to explore now that the novel's out?
One work that I was working on during my MFA that was not really about me necessarily was about my grandfather, and just like my lineage of like the people I come from, how different my life is from my grandfather's. And who grew up in Mississippi and had an outhouse and moved in the Great Migration with my grandma, the Chicago area or suburb of Chicago in the 50s. And like, he had a really interesting life, and it's watching the trajectory from him to my father, to me, and then same with my mom's side of my mom's grandma, like just all of those things. And so that's something that I've always thought about. But it's a big undertaking to kind of go into that. But I've thought about it.
All right. And so now I'm going to switch to my game. It's called Rewriting the Classics. We'll see how far we'll get. What's the one book you wished you would have written?
Because I love music so much. Donnie Walton's Final Revival of Opal and Ev, for sure. I love that book. Donnie's so great. The story is so great. And it's so original, and also like it feels like it could have happened. It feels like it should have happened, right?
Name one book where you want to change the ending, and how would you do it?
Oh. I think passing is the first thing that came to mind. And I know the ending actually. I believe the ending changed. Or was published with a different ending at one point. But instead of her pushing, I'm so bad with names, but instead of the main character pushing the other character out of the window, or possibly falling, I would have another ending.
Name a book that you think is overrated and why? Or overtaught?
Oh, overtaught. That is a very, that's a good one. Okay. I'm going to say that this one's not overtaught, but I think that we should read other things by this person, which is Lorraine Hansberry. I think A Raisin in the Sun is so good, but Lorraine Hansberry has so many other works that she had been working on and correspondences and things like that, that I think are a lot of people should know about. I'm not saying A Raisin in the Sun should be not taught. I'm saying that there should just be more. The Sign in Sidney Brewson's Window. She's written a children's story before. There's just so much. So I would say that. That's my political answer.
All right. So my final question for our interview today. You've started this illustrious literary career. When you are no longer on the earth and among the ancestors, what do you want someone to say about your work and the words that you left behind?
I want people to say I just really understood people. Like I in characters, I mean I love conversations like this. I love talking to people. I like to believe that I find a common ground with everyone I chat with, and I think that's really important. And so I'd like them to say that I saw people and understood people and really was trying to just make connections. For readers and for my characters, if that makes sense.
It does. Thank you, Zakiya.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This is so much fun. Your questions are so good and so hard sometimes.
Thank you. I was going to record it.
Big thank you to Zakiya Delilah Harris for being here on Black and Published today. Make sure you check out Zakiya's debut novel, The Other Black Girl, out now in paperback from Atria Books. And if you're not following Zakiya, follow her on the socials. She's at Zakiya Delilah Harris on Instagram and at Zakiya_Harris on Twitter. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Zakiya about her experience working in publishing. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. And Black and Published family, this is the last episode for season two. I'll be back with more authors, more books, more blackness, more writing, more publishing, more poetry, all that good stuff, the Tuesday after Labor Day. Until then, I'll holler at y'all next time. Peace.